You've tuned to The Turley Frequency, starring your host, Kevin Turley, with guest stars Mike Romano and Reed Hodges, and special guest stars, the members of the FCC, whom we respect respectfully. Now, time to get tuned into The Frequency. Call the show at 888-928-0881. That's 888-928-0881. Or text us at 251-928-2111. And now we cross live to the Archangel Radio Studios in downtown Fairhope to at last feel the Turley Frequency.
Yes, good morning and welcome. Today we meet Ralph Ellis, who by any measure is an unusual scholar of the ancient world, and who makes some very unusual historical claims in regard to the great and good book, the Bible. We meet him in the first segment. Top of the hour, we pray the Divine Mercy Chaplet, and you are invited to join us. Feel free to text us your prayer requests on 251-928-2111. Lines are open right now. Finally today, we take a look at how our Lenten journey is going, and we do so in the company of Father Timothy Vavarak. He'll be joining us in the final segment to discuss his book, As I Have Loved You, Rediscovering Our Salvation in Christ. Stick around till the last segment to find out more and hopefully get your Lent back on track. So with all this good stuff, I suppose we had better get on with this show. Hello and welcome. I hope your Monday morning is not too bad. I mean, Monday morning is Monday morning, right? It's always a bit of a shock to the system. You just had a wonderful day on Sunday, maybe relaxing with your family, and now it's the family trying to get back into the normal mode of the working week. So everybody's trying to get into work mode, and it's no different for us here. Now, today is a very special day this side of the Atlantic because the solemnity of St. Joseph, as you know, was yesterday, the 19th of March, but it's been shunted because of Sunday to today. So today I was thinking a lot about husbands, because that is what St. Joseph's feast day is all about. You know, St. Joseph has two feast days. He has one in May, which is the 1st of May, St. Joseph the Worker, which is a wonderful meditation upon his professional work, which was St. Joseph looking after the Holy Family through his labors and also teaching, no doubt, the infant Jesus all about the world of work. Have you ever thought about that? It was through St. Joseph's eyes that Jesus would have started to understand the world around him in regard to work and interactions with the world. But today, St. Joseph, the meditation is much more on St. Joseph, the husband of Our Lady, the protector of Our Lady, the protector of the Holy Family. But in particular, that relationship he had with Our Lady, which was of the most beautiful type and has been set out and talked about for the last 2,000 years. But in today's confused and confusing world, it's even more needed to be heard. Now, we've had a number of priests and lay people on this show who have waxed lyrical about St. Joseph, first of all, as a great intercessor, as a great protector, especially of women, but also a great protector against demons. One of his titles is St. Joseph, protector, terror of demons, which means that the demons run away when St. Joseph is set loose. It's quite funny because we had on an expert in the world of exorcisms, which was Michael Litchin. Do you remember Michael came on? And Michael, as you know, has written or edited and written books by exorcists and about exorcism and this. But I saw a quote that Michael, he was written an article about St. Joseph, and he said that an exorcist was recounting an exorcism that he had been involved in, and the name of St. Joseph had been invoked, and the devils replied, "Oh no, not him again," and ran off. So he is a powerful intercessor, and certainly on this show, we would like St. Joseph to be our protector. I often think St. Joseph should be the patron for radio talk show hosts. Yeah. And that's because he never said a word. He never said a word. St. Joseph the Silent. And I think because if your vocation calls you to use words, as mine does all the time, then you need that person who understands the value of words. Now, it's not that St. Joseph was mute. By no means. He would have very happily been spoken to Our Lady and Saint and the baby, the infant Jesus, and to the world around him. He was a man of the world. He would have to interact with the world. So he was able to talk and able to converse with the world around him. But the Bible recounts no words and records nothing that he ever said. So I think that St. Joseph the Silent might be a very good patron for all radio talk show hosts. Let me know what you think. Maybe you think there should be a little bit more silence. But just before we get on to this business of St. Joseph and what he might represent to us, I did a quick Google search for stories today about husbands and wives. And there's a whole range of very interesting stories that kick up. They've got nothing to do with St. Joseph, okay, because these are the secular news feeds that just throw up stories about husbands and wives if you ask them. What's the latest trending story? And there's a really heartwarming story from Australia. You may have heard of it. Happened just last week. And it involves two people in Australia, husband and wife, who are involved in trying to win that nation's lotto. So you've got Mega Millions in the United States. Well, whatever the equivalent was in Australia, they were trying to win it. Now, have you ever been in that situation? I haven't, I have to say. My wife and I don't... Well, I just have no interest in this sort of thing, but a lot of people do. So the husband and wife were religiously every single week buying tickets for the lottery, for the national lottery, hoping to win it. Australian couple, okay? And, you know, those conversations between husbands and wives, did you buy the tickets, you know, or did you put the tickets into the wash by accident, that sort of thing. What can I say? The wife was getting at the husband that he hadn't put in her preferred numbers, okay? And she was sort of nagging him about this, and she was getting mad about him. So he decided to submit twice as much, right? To try, you know, for some reason he purchased two lotto tickets instead of one, and decided to submit them both with the preferred numbers that his wife wanted. This was to get him out of the doghouse, says the news report. Maybe also to get them out of the poor house as well. You know, they were trying to... Anyway, he was just doing what husbands do, saying, yes, I made a mistake. Let me make up. Do this. Let me do this, right? And anyway, it all proved very, very fortuitous because guess what? The first ticket won. Yeah. He won, I think, $1 million, which roughly equates to about $668,000. Not bad, right? Not bad at all. What you could do with $668,000, I'm sure, if you want to phone in and tell me, fantastic. All of us could do with that sort of money suddenly dropping into our laps. But guess what? That second ticket, that won too. Can you believe it? Two tickets. Now, the odds of winning the Australian lottery twice are, according to this press report, unknown, right? But experts estimate that the odds of buying just one ticket that wins, a winning ticket, are 1 in 1.845 million. So the odds of having two tickets in the same week winning the lottery, you can't even start to equate them. So the family have now effectively won 2 million Australian dollars. So the equivalent now of well over $1 million. And they are absolutely delighted, you can imagine. And whatever little family friction there was between husband and wife has long since receded, as you can imagine, in such a situation. And the wife is quoted as saying, their names are kept back for obvious reasons, but she's saying, "My mind is racing all the time with all the things I can do for my family. I can buy my daughter a house. I can set up the children and grandchildren for the future," and so on and so forth. I think it's a rather lovely story because it's so unusual. It's so unusual. I mean, people do win the lottery, and that's wonderful, good or ill. Sometimes it doesn't work out for them, but most of the time it's a good story. But to win it twice, especially after a little bit of marital friction, is just wonderful. So this couple in Australia are very, very happy. Which leads me on to a less happy story, which I came across. I won't go into all the details, but it was one of those articles which are really clickbait, I guess. And it was about the critical error that husbands make with their wives, the essential error that husbands make with their wives. And, you know, sometimes you can't help yourself, right? You click on it and think, well, what is that all about? And, as I say, the article headline is much more inviting than the actual substance of the article. I'm not sure there's an awful lot to it. But guess what the one critical error men make that destroys relationships with their wives, or possibly their girlfriends? And it's called what they term shutting down. Shutting down. You ever done this? Ever experienced this? I suppose it means, according to the article, it means being emotionally withdrawn, not being present in a given situation, and therefore not able to connect with your wife. Now, I have to say that I did read something that countered this a few years ago and talked about the way that men's brains are wired. Now, I'm not a scientist. I'm just playing one on the radio. And I'm not a psychologist. I'm playing one on the radio. And I'm not a marriage counselor. But if you want to call in, I'll do my best. 888-928-0881. But basically, it was that men, and I think I can identify with this, that too much emotions being thrown at a man, especially verbally and probably especially by their wives, guess what? It causes men to shut down. So this article is suggesting, I suppose, that somehow men are deliberately shutting down, that when things get too emotional, they cut off and they go off. Now, there may be an element of truth in that. I just don't know. But what this other article was saying, which I read a few years ago, was that there's some sort of chemical imbalance in our brains, which means that there's a kind of default switch. You hit the trip switch and we inevitably shut down. We can't respond because it's emotional overload. Any men out there who can identify with that? The only thing I will say, and I remember where I worked once, I had had to counsel people a little bit about this because they were dealing with men and women in an emotional situation. And I remember somebody saying to me, and I thought it was true, and the more I thought about it, the more I think it's true, that women are very, very good at talking about emotions. Now, this is basic stuff. We know this, right? Women are geniuses at talking about emotions and their own emotions in particular. And they're very good at phoning each other up and just having a discussion about their emotional well-being and all the rest. Men are not good at this. So a sure way to get a man to shut up is a husband or a boyfriend or whatever it happens to be, is to ask him, how are you? Ask a man directly, how are you? And I would wage money that you will get a nondescript, monosyllabic response of fine, okay, no problem, great, never felt better, whatever, i.e. a meaningless response. Because men don't tend to have that ability sometimes to work out how they're feeling. Now, I know lots of people say this is so sexist and all. I'm just telling you what I've seen, what I know, okay? Take it and use it, throw it out the window, do whatever you want with it. I don't mind. I'm just telling you what I think. But what I've often said to women in that situation is, don't keep asking how he feels. Ask him something else. And he'll tell you how he feels, but using something else. So, for example, let's say his favorite hobby is fixing his car. To say to him, how's that car going? How does that car make you feel? How does fixing that car make you feel? You'll get a lot of response. Men are not shy about talking about the things they like. They're not shy about monologuing, as you can hear, about the things that interest them. But it's when it comes to emotions, they feel slightly at sea, slightly out of sync. So my tip, I mean, this article, take it, I'm not even going to refer to it because I'm not sure it's absolutely. Yes, men do shut down, but there's another way in which you can open a man up, which is to go sideways. Don't go full on, go sideways. Now, it just so happened at the weekend that I was, it was St. Joseph's Day or on the eve of St. Joseph's Day, and I was watching, I started watching these videos on YouTube, which are known as reaction videos. Have you come across these? And they are basically people reacting to music videos. And I came across this a few months ago, and I started watching some of them, and they became quite interesting because it's fun watching people's reactions, especially if they're quite articulate. Some of them are very good technically, voice coaches and all the rest of it, and they can tell you how a song, why it's impacting, and the vocal range of the singer and all of that sort of stuff, which is very, very interesting. And but what's also interesting is watching different generations encounter different musical experiences. So I came across a young woman on Saturday night. I was watching it, who for the first time in her life, she's from the United States, I think from the Southern States by her accent. But she'd never really watched an Elvis music video, an Elvis singing. You know, she heard of Elvis. She knew who Elvis was. And she had never really sort of experienced it. So she sat and she watched Elvis singing one of his great hits. Are You Lonesome Tonight? Love Me Tender. It was one of those songs from the 1950s, which is very slushy, very romantic, very, you know, this sort of stuff that was pretty typical in the 1950s, 60s, and even 70s and 80s to some extent. But what really interested me was her reaction to it. And I'm going to play, I don't know if we've got media file one ready. I'm just going to play a little clip of her reaction because I think it gives us a real insight into something. So, Reed, if you wouldn't mind just playing that clip.
You know what really irritates me is that like what happened? I want this. Bring this back.
What she goes on to say then, thank you, Reid, for that. What she goes on to say is that what happened? You know, she goes on and on and on about how music videos today, the whole dating scene today, the sort of clicking on your whatever the Tinder, whatever those things that people look at and look at their profiles. She just goes into one about how it makes her feel. And why can't she have somebody like an Elvis singing lovely romantic songs about how much that woman means to the man? And I thought, she said, we lost something. Something happened. And then she asked, what happened? Well, I could tell you what happened. It was called the sexual revolution in the 1960s. But anyway, that's for another day and another story. But wasn't it interesting that this millennial woman, this young woman who's got all these different videos, whenever she comes across something which is so romantic and so old-fashioned in the best sense, she's saying, that's what I want. I want that. I want to go back to the way it was when men were men, women were women, and men, they courted women. They courted them because they valued them. And they valued them because they wanted to marry them and they wanted to have families with them. Now, I don't want to paint too rosy a picture of the past. That's not what I'm saying. But we've gone way, way in the other direction, right? Way, way in the other direction. And I'm not sure it's making anybody happy, men, women, or anybody in between, which is why, going back to St. Joseph, he is so important today, because he is reminding men of what it is to be a man. But he's also reminding women of the standard for what it is to be a man. So today, when we're celebrating St. Joseph, absolutely. But St. Joseph is not some relic from 2,000 years ago or even just some sort of pious saint. He is a saint for today and for the problems of today. So we ask St. Joseph to pray for us. Now, when we come back, we are delving into the past. We are going back to Egypt with Ralph Ellis and his very unusual take on the archaeology of Egypt. Stay tuned to the Turley Frequency. Live and exclusive here on Archangel Radio, and I am joined by Ralph Ellis. Ralph has been researching biblical and Egyptian history for more than 30 years, and he is, by his own admission, independent of what some would describe as theological and educational establishments. And this allows Ralph to tread where others fear to, and it is through this independence that he claims to have discovered new aspects in regard to Bible history and Egypt history, and indeed history of the ancient world. And Ralph joins me down the line this morning. Ralph, welcome to the Turley Frequency. Ralph, you just might want to unmute.
Yes, indeed, that was muted. I'm not quite sure why. Good to be with you.
Good morning, Ralph. How are you doing?
Very well, thank you. Yes, afternoon over here.
It is indeed. I can hear by your accent you're from somewhere in England.
Yes, indeed. Born and bred a Londoner, but now in northwest England, and just coming into a very nice spring day.
Wonderful. Ralph, I'm not sure. I mean, I was looking at some of your writings. And, I mean, you write about the ancient world so extensively, it's very hard to find somewhere to start. I mean, let's begin maybe with ancient Egypt and some of your claims around that. Where do you think the major misconceptions are about ancient Egypt?
Well, the major misconception is the status and the power of the Israelites in Egypt. It's obviously claimed that the Israelites were merely slaves in Egypt. But if you read Josephus Flavius, who is Judaism's greatest historian, he says that the ancient Israelites were the Hyksos pharaohs of Egypt, which is a very different sort of concept. But I think he's correct in that. So people who don't know the Hyksos, they were an invading people who came down into Egypt from Canaan, took over mostly northern Egypt. This would be circa about 1900 BC, something of that nature. Mm-hmm. And they were there for 100 or 200 years or so, and they were kicked out of Egypt on a grand exodus. And it just so happens, of course, that exodus is exactly the same as the Old Testament Exodus event. Mm-hmm. So we have a group of people who were known as shepherds. They were circumcised and they had curly side locks of hair. They had a pharaoh, was called Jacob or Jacoba, which is very interesting, of course. They had the plagues. There was 3 days of darkness. There was the great ash fall. which Moses mentions, of course, but that happened in real history. There was the parting of the waters because there was a great tsunami. And of course, as you know, during a tsunami, the water rushes out before it comes back in again. So the waters did indeed part. And 400,000 people supposedly were kicked out of Egypt on this great exodus. And they went from Pi Ramesses and they traveled to Jerusalem. And en route, they destroyed Jericho. Mm-hmm. Now, this is the history of the Hyksos pharaohs of Egypt. This is nothing to do with the Bible, supposedly. But as you can see, it is pretty much exactly the same. The only thing that's different is the date.
Indeed. And I mean, just to make clear, because obviously this is a Catholic radio station, Ralph, a lot of your research, it's similar to what's in the Bible, but it has a different slant on it. Would that be a fair way of describing your research? I mean, you come to different conclusions, basically.
Well, yes. I mean, this is a good example. These two Exodus events are exactly the same, except for their dates. You know, the Hyksos Exodus happened in about 1580 BC, so something like 300-400 years earlier than the classical date for the biblical Exodus. But here we have two identical events. So do we consider them to be the same or totally separate? It's worth considering whether these are actually the same event and someone has just merely garbled the date that it happened. Mm-hmm. And sort of perhaps maybe you might say garbled the name and the status of the people involved. Because, as I say, Josephus Flavius, who is Judaism's greatest historian, says that the Hyksos pharaohs of Egypt were our forefathers. Mm-hmm. So why don't we agree with him? I mean, he had better resources than we have today. Why don't we agree with him that that was actually the Israelite Exodus, but it happened in 1580 BC? It's worth considering.
Mm-hmm. Well, it's fascinating. I suppose the question, though, really is, I mean, when you're dealing with events which are so far in the past, I mean, really, I mean, we're not even talking ancient history. We're almost talking prehistory in a sense. There has to be some element where something happened. I mean, that's obvious from the many sources that we have. But it's, I mean, when you're talking specific timings, when you're talking specific events, you're talking of 1,000 or more years before it was written down. Things can get a bit vague, I guess.
Not in this particular case, because in this particular case, we have a chronological and historical hook upon which we can hang this particular event. So the event was actually caused by the eruption of Santorini in the Mediterranean. Mm-hmm. It was the biggest volcano within recorded history. So we have a chronological hook that we can put it on, and that was 1600 BC. So we're talking very much the right era. Mm-hmm. And the other thing is that we know it happened better than if someone actually gave us a video, perhaps, because what we have here is four or five what you might call black swan events. Mm-hmm. Now, a black swan event is something that's so unpredictable, you would never actually make up that story because it's outside your experience. But here we have four or five of these all at the same time. Things like, you know, the tsunami, the great ash fall, the 3 days of darkness, and the pillar of fire and the pillar of smoke and everything. All of those events are connected to a maritime volcano, the eruption of Santorini. Now, how would an ancient chronicler know that all of those events that they recorded for the Exodus were all linked to a maritime volcano? Mm-hmm. The only way that could happen is if this was an eyewitness account of what actually happened, and they just recorded it down. So we can be fairly sure that this actually happened. It's a true account of what happened. The only thing in my view that has actually changed is the date has changed, because that's been garbled down the centuries, and the status of the people has been garbled. They were shepherds, but they weren't mere shepherds with a few flocks of starving sheep. They were actually shepherd kings. The Hyksos were known as the shepherd kings.
Yes, I suppose as well, though, there's also a debate around the meaning of that. But to tell me this, Ralph, because you're obviously an independent scholar, and your sort of thesis flies in the face of so much historical research, biblical or otherwise, that has happened. What's the sort of reaction you find either amongst archaeologists or biblical scholars when you posit this idea?
It depends who you speak to. Now, we're over in Britain here, so I'm normally talking to Protestant priests, and they're quite open to this idea. In fact, they warm to this idea, especially on the Old Testament material, because it makes sense of the text, of items that never made sense before. That was always the problem that we had with agnostics and Protestant Christians, is that because you could not find this history in the real history of that part of the world, therefore it became fictional. It was less believable. Mm-hmm. But if you can actually put it back into history and find the history, it becomes more believable. So from the agnostic point of view, from the Protestant point of view, they've actually warmed to it and said, this actually makes a great deal of sense. It makes sense of the texts that we had and we believed in, but seemed mythical. Now they seem historical. Within the Catholic world, I'd say there's a bit more resistance to that, because there's more of an idea that this is the absolute word of God, and therefore the dating and the status of these people has to be correct. But the greatest resistance comes actually, very strangely, I think, from the historical fraternity. Mm-hmm. And they have built their own structures, their own sort of classical history of the world, which is even more rigid than any sort of Christian biblical viewpoint, which I find very strange, because they will say, because they've done all of the archaeology, the Exodus never happened. It's complete myth, which, of course, Christians will ignore, because what else can they say? And then I come along to the historians and I say, look, you're doing the wrong archaeology, because you're looking in the wrong era. You're looking in the 1100s, 1200s BC, and that's why you can't find any history of this Exodus event. But if you look in 1580 BC, you will find it. And that gets dismissed out of hand, which I find quite surprising. So, yes, that's the different reactions you get to this sort of research.
No, I mean, it doesn't surprise me at all, Ralph. I mean, some of the most dogmatic people I know are people who are teaching certain aspects of history from certain periods, and they have a vested interest. Well, they are so invested in their own projects that they become very defensive. So that doesn't surprise me at all. Of course, though, there's something here, Ralph, which is a Catholic understanding of Scripture, which is that the Bible is not a historical text per se. It's divine revelation, which sets it onto a different level. But I'm just wondering, really, I mean, everything you've said, in a way, I mean, is there a way in which it sort of complements, or even there could be a fusion of what you're saying and sort of basic Catholic orthodoxy when it comes to the Bible? We both agree something happened. Your interpretation of the events is very interesting, linking it to certain phenomena that occurred at the time. Our interpretation of its meaning might be different, but to have historical references to something actually taking place, when you both know that for many years there was a historical current, if you like, that said Moses was a fictional character, that the Israelites never really existed in Egypt. You must have heard that.
Yes. Well, they had to say that because nobody could find the evidence. And therefore, the fallback position was, as you say, it's divine revelation. But that's only because you're trying to escape from the conundrum that none of the evidence can be found. If the evidence could be found, you'd say, ha, there's the evidence. You see, our book is correct. So the divine revelation is stepping back from the story and retreating from it and you're having to make up excuses. But what I've done with my research is I've proven that 90% of the Old Testament is actually correct. It's a historical record. Now, that should be greeted, one would expect, with some sort of joy, I suppose, that, you know, here at last is evidence mm-hmm. for these texts. The problem with the history that I've teased out of the Old Testament is that it doesn't quite accord with what classical Christianity has been teaching for the last however long, 2,000 years or whatever, because it's slightly different. And the main thing that's being different is the power and influence of the people involved. Obviously, the Hyksos pharaohs were actually not slaves in Egypt. They were the most powerful people in the world at the time. It came up with a funny message on Skype. So the power and of the people involved was much greater. These were pharaohs of Egypt. These were very influential people, and they still managed to get themselves kicked out of Egypt because they were a controlling authority. They didn't necessarily control the whole of the land. If you can imagine, the scenario is similar to the British Raj in India. When mm-hmm. the British ruled India, we were a very powerful controlling authority within India. But, of course, we didn't control the whole of the land.
That's true.
And so eventually, after 200 years, I don't know how long the Raj continued for, actually, Britain got kicked out of the country. Mm-hmm. So it's a very similar scenario to that.
Ralph, just hold that thought for a moment. We're going to take a quick break. If you would like to pose any questions to Ralph Ellis, who's an independent biblical scholar and a scholar of Egypt, then feel free to phone the show on 888-928-0881 or text me on 251-928-2111, and I'd be only too happy to pose your questions. We'll be back right after these words. Stay tuned to the Turley Frequency. The Turley Frequency here, live and exclusive on Archangel Radio. I'm in the midst of a fascinating discussion with our guest, Ralph Ellis. Ralph, just before the break, I was trying to think of how I was describing you, which may not be how you would describe. I mean, how would you describe yourself? You're a bit of an outlier in terms of the Bible, archaeology. How do you, if I was to meet you on a train or a plane, how would you say, or how would you describe what you do?
Yes, I'm sort of a median between two extremes at present. You've got the literalists who will say, everything in the Bible is true because it's the word of God, etc., and therefore we have to believe it even if there's no evidence. And then, of course, you get the sort of archaeologists, sort of more the agnostic side, the mythicists, I think they call them nowadays, who will say the entire Bible is myth, because there is no evidence. You can't find that evidence in the historical record. Mm-hmm. I never thought that was tenable because it reads like a history book. It doesn't read like a fantasy novel. And so we ought to be able to find some real archaeology and history within these texts. And it transpired very quickly that you can, if you just slightly reinterpret various aspects of it, and the things that seem to have been changed down the centuries are either the date of the event, the status of the people involved, or the location of the event has been changed. And that's why you cannot find these people in the historical record. Now, with the Exodus, as we've just been talking about, it's the date that's changed. It's like 400 years earlier than people have ascribed to it. And that's why you can't find the evidence. With the United Monarchy, I found, you know, David and Solomon. I found them in the historical record. But the date is exactly the same. Exactly the same. But the location has changed. They're no longer in Zion, which is Jerusalem. They were in Zoan, which is Tanis. And so, of course, you cannot find them in the historical record because you're looking in the wrong place. So when the archaeology was done by, you know, Finkelstein and Silberman and so on, looking into Jerusalem for the United Monarchy, who was supposed to be, you know, the most powerful monarchs in that region at that time, people came from all over the known world to visit David and Solomon. They were so powerful and wealthy. And yet their conclusion was that Jerusalem was no more than a village at that time. So there was no United Monarchy.
Absolutely. You're listening to the voice of Ralph Ellis, who is an independent scholar and researcher into the events and world, the ancient world. We have a caller, Ralph, who wants to pose some questions, but I'm having slight difficulty. She's coming to us via Skype. And I'm having a slight difficulty adding her to our call.
Perhaps you can read out the question, maybe?
Let me just see if that adds her to the group. No. Mike or Reed, our producers, could you add Dr. Amal to our conversation if you can? She's on. Oh, she's there. She's there now. Amal, are you there? Good morning, Amal. Or good afternoon in your case. Yes.
Hello, good afternoon. Good afternoon.
So Ralph, just to explain, Dr. Amal is not only a frequent contributor to the show on many aspects, but she's also a listener to the show and sometimes wants to ask questions. And Dr. Amal is a Cambridge academic. She's too humble to talk about all her various qualifications, but she's very high powered in all sorts of ways. And also, Dr. Amal comes originally from the Middle East, so has a particular interest in this realm. Dr. Amal, I'm going to introduce you to Ralph Ellis, and you can ask your question.
Yeah, thank you. Thank you so much. And thank you for the fascinating. I didn't know about your book and your research, and I'm now very, very interested. I'm definitely going to look into it. My question is for you. You know, like I agree with many things that you say, but here's my what I understand. Just to make it clear, you know, like I'm specialist in Arabic linguistics and traditional Arabic linguistics, and I looked into the origins of Arabic linguistics because they say always that, you know, it's shrouded in mist. We don't know anything. And I've tried and I've proved, you know, like we can know something, not for sure, but we can know something. And for me, it's now time. That is very, very interesting because I can only tell, you know, I'm going to talk about my experience with time with my family, which is still very Semitic. And we, you know, like, I mean, really, the older generation in my family was a sort of, you know, still biblical in a sense. And the way that we looked at time was very different because, for example, my grandmother would never talk about years. She would always talk about events. So when you ask her about when was her youngest son born, she couldn't tell you what year it was, but she would tell you it was the year when so-and-so was a king.
Mm.
Or when that this and that normal, happened. Yes. So I think that we have to look at the Bible, you know, like, I mean, I'm sure that there will be some, you know, some differences in time. I mean, I don't know if calculating time has changed in the meantime, but one thing that we have to bear in mind that is still very, you know, like until very recently, time was looked at differently. It was in terms of events. So I can imagine that the person who wrote about, you know, the events in the Bible were not very particular about which year. And I can imagine that once you have kings and you have administrative system in work, then you will be more and more accurate. But I can imagine that people were looking at events and in terms of events, talking about their experience with God.
That's
what
a
do you
very,
think? I mean, I don't know if you,
I was just going to say, Amal, that's a really, really interesting point. Ralph, I'm sure you have thought long and hard about it, though.
Yes, indeed. Three questions there: time, chronological hooks, and the language. So very quickly, yes, the time has changed. That's why, for, you know, for Noah and people of that nature, we get lives of 900 years and so on. But Manetho, the Egyptian historian, says that in those days, the Egyptians calculated years with lunar years. So you have to divide Noah's 900 years by 13 to get solar years. And then it comes back into more normal lifespans. So, yes, the timing has changed. When this actually happened, as you say, yes, we do hook on events to, you know, monarchs and various things that happened. Well, this is exactly what we can do with the Exodus story. We can hook it on to the plagues events and what happened at that time, which was caused by the Santorini eruption, which was the biggest explosion in the Mediterranean basin in recorded history. Of course, someone was going to record this huge, great explosion in the Mediterranean, which affected all of the lands from Greece to Anatolia to the Near East, down into Egypt. And someone was going to record that massive explosion and the ashfall, the great ashfall that came out at that time. Remember, the Old Testament says, Moses, God said unto Moses, take you handfuls of ash from the hearth of the fire and throw it up into the sky, and it will become a small dust across the whole land of Egypt. Mm-hmm. Well, that is exactly what happened. It's a perfect description of the long-range fallout from the Santorini eruption. So that gives us a chronological hook upon which we can hang the whole of the Exodus story. And that explosion took place in 1600 BC. And just very quickly on the Arabic, I would love it if you could actually do some further research on this. But I've written a book which says basically that Aramaic and therefore Arabic are just ancient Egyptian. So they are still speaking ancient Egyptian because I've made a 400-word dictionary of Egyptian to Aramaic words, mainly taken from Wallace Budge, who's the ancient, you know, venerable Egyptologist who wrote, you know, the Dictionary of Hieroglyphs. And the way they translated many of the hieroglyphs was by comparing ancient Egyptian with Coptic, of course, because they're still speaking Egyptian, and Aramaic, and also with Arabic, but mostly with Aramaic. And so his idea and my idea is these are the same languages, because if you think about it, Joseph was prime minister of Egypt. Moses was the chief army commander of Egypt. These people would have spoken fluent Egyptian, and that's where this language has flowed down into Aramaic.
Yeah, Amal, but many people don't.
Sorry. Please, Amal, respond. Yes, absolutely. Go ahead.
Yeah, no, it's very interesting because I think that many people forget how important Aramaic was. Aramaic at that time in the ancient world was as English today.
Yes.
So even in the Persian Empire, Aramaic was for very long the administrative work. It was the lingua franca. Aramaic.
Yes, indeed.
So I'm not surprised that, you know, like I don't know what Joseph would have spoken, but I'm sure that if Aramaic was as English today, I'm sure that people would communicate in the language that is most known, maybe not perfectly. So, I mean, language contact is very possible, but I can't imagine that Aramaic could be, you know, originated from, or that Coptic and Aramaic are the same. I know that there is language contact. I'm sure that there is maybe similarities, but I doubt, you know, like, but I think that many people forget that Aramaic was really like English today, that, you know, like you'll go to China and they will speak English, you know, like Chinese English, and you go to the Middle East there, and, you know, like, I mean, and everyone will, and also, you know, like you have English terms and words and expressions that will, you know, will enter your language and become part of your own language. And then when you go and you compare it and you say, oh yeah, there are similarities, maybe there is some influence here, but actually there isn't a direct influence. It's just the fact that one language at a particular time was the most important language, or the, you know, the language that many people would speak, like French. I mean, you can see, for example, the 19th century, there was more influence of French, and you have many Arabic expressions which are influenced, which are direct translation from French. And once the influence of French waned, you know, like now you have more influence of English. And most interestingly now is that because many Aramaic-speaking people have been living abroad, and especially in the States and in English-speaking countries, so now you have many English expressions and way of saying of, you know, things which are a direct translation into Aramaic.
Yes, indeed. But just if I can interject, if the Israelites were actually the Hyksos pharaohs of Egypt, because their exodus is identical, then the Hyksos people were a fully Egyptianized people. They spoke Egyptian. All of the texts we have from the Hyksos period are actually in Egyptian. Therefore, the common language of the Hyksos stroke Israelites would have been Egyptian, which means that when they went on their exodus, they went away speaking Egyptian, and therefore Aramaic would be a daughter language of ancient Egyptian. And these two languages appear to be very similar. I mean, I have a text here from, I forget who wrote this one, Aramaic words in Egyptian. But of course, I think that is round the wrong way, because the dominant civilization would be Egyptian. Therefore, it would be Egyptian words in Aramaic. And then I have my own dictionary, which I've made, which has got 400 words, showing the similarity between these two languages. And of course, when they went out across the Mediterranean on their various exoduses, because the Israelites have been pushed out several times, they would have taken that language with them. And that language became Aramaic.
Listen, Amal, I'm afraid this is fascinating. Ralph, I'm sure you weren't expecting a Cambridge Arabist to come on with such intricate knowledge of Aramaic and the ancient world, and it's a fascinating discussion.
I would love to have a more of a discussion about it.
Well, we will have maybe we'll have a three-way discussion on the next occasion, but just for today, yes. I'm going to have to say goodbye to Dr. Amal. Thank you so much for your intervention. Ralph, thank you for coming on and being willing to engage so openly and so charmingly with all our questions on this. But tell people where they can find out more about you and your work.
Yes, it's most of my books are now available on Amazon. So this Old Testament work starts with Jesus, Last of the Pharaohs. Then it continues with Tempest and Exodus, which is obviously about the Exodus. Jesus, Last of the Pharaohs is mostly about what we've been discussing, actually, the Hyksos pharaohs of Egypt. And then I've got Eden in Egypt, which is connecting the biblical story with Pharaoh Akhenaten and Nefertiti, because there are some elements.
Ralph, thank you so much. We're going to have to say goodbye. I'm afraid the clock has beaten us. That was Ralph Ellis. Thank you so much for coming on the show this morning. When we come back, we'll be praying the Divine Mercy Chaplet. Stay with us here on Archangel Radio.